Succession number 4638, room number 2.
This is tape number 2, Mr. Scheuer. And you got a posting to Singapore, and perhaps you could tell us how this went and how you got there and what
yes.
sort of things you did when you got there.
Yes, I went to... I'm trying to recall which dock I went to. I don't know whether it was from Southampton. I think it was Southampton. I think it was Liverpool, and I boarded the troop ship, the Neuralia, which was a very good name, should have been Neuralgia, and the discipline still continued on board this vessel, and we were lower than the lowest. We were shoved down below decks and showed where our hammocks were and the bedding, which we had to roll out. And I dreaded this because of my seasickness problem. So we set sail, as it were. And our food was, well, it was food. It was nothing to write home about except to complain. They wouldn't have got you anywhere anyway. After it took about 4 or 5 days before I could eat anything because of this being sick problem, I found that after we got round the corner heading into the Mediterranean around about Gib, I was beginning to recover and getting a bit of life about me. I still felt groggy, my head was mussy, but I was beginning to get some life in, and I was detailed off for various duties along with other chaps, and one of the jobs we had to do was get the messing, get the food, which we took in turn, and this was a ghastly operation because it was an open sort of cookhouse where we collected our food from, which was positioned alongside what is called in the Navy the heads, which was the toilets, which were also open construction. There were no such thing as doors or privacy. You just plonked yourself in there and the people outside lining up for the food. And of course an unfortunate thing about these heads was that it consisted of a long pipe which ran the length of the whole seating arrangement, open, and if the boat rocked very much, it would come over the top because it quite often got jammed up with rubbish and stuff, and if you were unlucky, you'd get it over your feet while you were queuing up waiting for food. But this was, I suppose, another piece of training which we had to put up with. After that, we got the food in the various buckets and tinned receptacles, and we take it down below to the mess, and you'd be the first one at the table because they're at the end of the table, and you'd have to dish this lot out. And I was rather grateful to get rid of mine. I passed mine on to anybody that wanted it, and got a good mark. All metal plates, of course, and then afterwards everything was cleared up and cleared away, and we had an hour or two to wander around. Then we'd have to prepare our beds, which was sling your hammock up and unfold these blankets and get into it and get your head down. Well, if you can imagine several hundred airmen body to body on a hammock swinging all together as the boat went to and fro with various sweaty socks and things sculling around, the atmosphere was far from sweet. I put up with this for about another, not quite a week, I suppose. And meanwhile, we'd taken on some buffs from Gibraltar. We were taking them on to India. And I put up with this for about a week, and I thought, well, this is it. And I clambered up on the top deck at night, just as if the lights out went, and I slipped on the deck up by the lifeboat box, crept in behind it and slept there, and got some fresh air, and this eased the situation a bit. I was never really 100% fit the whole time of the journey, although, as I say, I did manage to master the sickness, which was a step in the right direction.
And arrived in Singapore to join the squadron.
Yes, we went through the Med, through the Suez, and getting hotter and hotter, and finally, I've forgotten how many weeks it took now, but longer than I care to remember, we arrived at Singapore, and we're all in our shorts and gear by this time, having packed away our blue stuff. And there was on the quay side at Singapore were all the Chinese coolies and Malays, rickshaws, and a smell which is always reminiscent of Singapore in particular in the Far East, and there was fried onions and pineapple, rotten pineapple. And on the quay there were military figures of the station warrant officer and his senior NCOs waiting for their victims. And as we marched off the boat, they were us with all our white knees and peculiar helmets. We'd all been issued with our cork type helmets, waiting to be marshalled by the warrant officer who went along selecting his various victims. Fortunately, of course, I was a tradesman by this time, a wireless operator, and I didn't come under his direct command except for moving around from station to station till we got there. We were loaded up on lorries and off we went to Changi. Now, Changi in those days was just been vacated by the army, and it was used by us as a transit camp. And for normal purposes, when the trooping season wasn't on, it was used as a rest camp, because they had these great big barrack block buildings, and there were a few small houses for married types, you know, for the army. But it was all a thrill, because you saw bananas growing and pineapples and something which you'd never seen before, and the smells and the noises from the Chinese, and how they would run across the road and try and get as close to a vehicle as possible, because their religion, I suppose it is, tells them that they're always being followed by the devil, and if they can get as near as damn it being knocked over by a vehicle, they were highly pleased, because that meant the devil went for a Burton. And all these things. And also near Changi, there was a small village of Changi itself. They put on a Chinese show after we'd been there for about a week, and it was a Chinese play. And their plays can go on for days, weeks, or months. But we all went down there because we were naturally interested to learn, find out all about the Chinese and to be friends, and this sort of, or Malays, some of them. And one of our chaps, he brought with him a trombone. And we didn't go much on this trombone playing, but he took this with him, and we went down there, and before we could say Jack Robinson, he was up on the stage with the rest of these playing his trombone, and we were made very welcome. They thought this was lovely, this white airman coming down playing this musical instrument. So we spent quite a good evening there. We got back, and actually a bit earlier than this, we when we went to bed for the first time in these blocks, these big barrack blocks we were in, we had the old iron folding sort of bed, which you could push back, and it made an armchair, iron slats. You could hardly call them springs, or that's what they were supposed to be. They were too stiff, had no movement in them at all. And we had the three biscuits, so-called three mattresses, which fitted on the top. And we all went to bed the first night, and we had the circular mozzie nets, which we let down and tucked ourselves in. There were no doors, they were all open doorways, which was quite interesting to us as well, and we still had plenty of air in. In the morning, when we woke up, we all looked as though we'd got a disease. We were all lumps, face and hands, and any part of the body that wasn't covered up, and which was the most of it, because you only had a sheet anyway, was covered in these huge red lumps and itching like the dickens. So we started to make an investigation, and we found that up in the wooden hoop around which this mosquito net was fitted were bugs. And they crept down the mozzie net during the night and had their fill. So we told a sergeant about this, and he said, "Oh, we'll fix that, we'll get those cleaned out." So we took those down, and at the same time, we started looking around the beds, and although the beds were metal, there were bugs in between where the pins went to hold the legs on, things like that. The thing was alive with them. And this wasn't just my bed, it was everybody's bed. So he brought in a blow lamp for the bed, which we got cracking, and we went in cooking this lot as we heated the bed so they'd pop and crack and drop out. The mozzie nets was a different thing. We got here Chinese women who would come and sit on the veranda all day to do little jobs for you, like sewing your buttons on, or doing any mending work, or ironing, or washing. So we piled all these mozzie nets out and got them, told them what we wanted, and they got them cracking on that. Which they did. They cleaned those out all right. Later on, I found that in similar circumstances, later on we had another thing similar to that, that all your bedding was put outside in the hot sun, and that was the way of keeping these bugs at bay, as it were, keeping them clear, and they were left outside. But that was just one of the trials that hit us right away. And of course there were mosquitoes which had to be avoided, although it was fairly safe really from disease in those days. In the earlier days, of course, it was rife, you got every disease going there. And of course we had all our proper inoculations and vaccinations before we left England anyway. And by about another week of this, and of course we were strolling around, and there was what they called paggers. And they're like stakes which are wired together, and they go out in the sea, and they made a swimming pool which is fairly safe and will keep out larger fish which might attack you, sharks, stingrays and that sort of thing. I mean, you could go swimming, but none of us went then, because we were all a bit dubious about what we might tread on or meet in the water. And then we went on from Changi to Salita, as the people we were leaving had now vacated and were on the way home. We joined up with the wireless section, and our little wireless building was just on the attached to the hangar, just on the outside. And we were introduced to the rest of the staff and the flying personnel, and detailed off to which aircraft we were responsible for communication purposes. And then we would be introduced to the pilot and to the fitter, who was a very useful person to know, because the fitter and the wireless operator were the two main crew members. There was a rigger, of course, but he never went on cruises. They had to travel light on cruises, because they took their own food, drinks, and Rose's lime juice was a great favourite to keep the nature under control. But we started off doing radio communication with air-to-ground and air-to-air, and various experiments. It wasn't long before I applied to be trained as an air gunner, and there were two or three other chaps in the squadron at the same time applied, and we all were accepted, and We started our air gunnery course of training. We had ground lectures and in the armoury, where we had to assemble the guns practically blindfolded. I mean, Lewis guns. It was fairly straightforward. And then we went to prove ourselves. We'd take the guns down onto the aircraft and fit them on the scarf rings that were fitted on the cockpits. All open cockpits, of course, on these aircraft. And I went to what was called in those days Sisters Island, Blackamatty. The names have changed nowadays, but they were just on the outside of the harbour, Singapore Harbour itself, which was the opposite side of the island to Salita. We'd fly around there and we'd have air-to-ground target shooting, and there would be one of our old pinnaces there from the MT section and motorboat section to keep the water clear from native boats and fishermen and so on. And when we finished firing our rounds, we'd fire somewhere about 300 or 400 rounds each man. We'd fire a green Veery cartridge or red green Veery cartridge to the motorboat crew to say all okay, and off we go back to the base and pass somebody else coming out to take over. Well, we did qualify as air gunners, and because that was very pleasing to put up the air gunner's badge, which had just changed from a cloth. It used to be a cloth bullet with wings, and this has changed now to a brass bullet with wings. So by the time we got our brass bullet up and our handful of sparks underneath that, and perhaps an LAC's badge underneath that, we had a nice armful. We were like Boy Scouts, but we were very proud of it. And I think most airmen, when they join the Air Force, their real basic object is to be in the air, to be able to fly. And we were looked upon as semi-heroes, because you couldn't go wrong in England. If you were flying, people would fall over themselves. And we were always getting people wanting to come aboard to have a look around, and the same thing continued out in the Far East. You'd have visitors from all ranks, all services, would come want to come have a look at these aircraft. So from this, after this qualifying, we went on a cruise to the Andaman and Nicobar Islands in the Indian Ocean. This was around the Christmas period, and the idea was to take photographs of reefs which appeared to shift around a bit, and the work, so we were told, was photography and survey work was normally done by the Navy, who again we were told took up to about 7 years to do work we did in 3 months. We flew up to Rangoon, and then from Rangoon down to Port Blair, which was the sort of dockyard of the Andamans. The capital was Ross Island, which we weren't on, but was just across the water from us. And to get there, where they would run a little ferry service, and the army were based there, and so were several white families. It was the Buffs they'd come from Rangoon. And we spent a really adventurous time there, flying around all the different islands, and where some of the natives had never seen a white man, and most certainly had never seen an aircraft. And again, we had this wonderful feeling that these people coming out nearly wanting to bow down to us. And we used to carry with us a tea chest on the first few occasions, and it was filled up. It was like trader horn that you read about. It was full of beads and brooches and tin pot jewellery that the kiddies would use, full up with this stuff. And once we got the head man to come aboard and he saw this, he thought he was on Treasure Island. So we loaded him up with handfuls of these peculiar cheap jewels, and he'd give them to his women outside somewhere, but most of them he would keep for himself and earn his own neck. And our pilot had also got some drink with him. I don't know whether this was quite the thing, but he's got some drink, and it was the type of stuff you see in comic films, that you drop some on the floor and it explodes with a bang. And he gave this old head man a half a pint glass full of this stuff, and he knocked it back straight down. We were amazed, he didn't choke or anything. And then off he went back to his swamps, and they went through a mangrove swamps they were, and he and I suppose about five or six other boats filled with these the villagers all disappeared. They just no sign at all. We hung around for about half an hour, three quarters of an hour, and presently out they come, edging out of the mangroves, came back and brought with them sheets of tortoise shell, which presumably was payment for all the jewels and and drink we'd given them, and loaded this stuff aboard, which the pilot had. we never saw any of it after that, after being loaded aboard, and then we flew back to our base. That was one little interesting part there.
But all this time you were on a long detachment, were you, at the Andamans or the Nicobar?
Yes, it was. I don't know that it was tied down a particular period of time, but it took about 3 months. And towards the end of that time, I started up my sickness problem again, and I got relieved. Fortunately, we'd taken a spare operator who normally would have gone up to Fort Blair radio station, which was manned by, I think it was Eurasian operators, and a Eurasian boss. He would go up there to keep an ear open on us signalling, so that we were, had some communications with them, you see. Anyway, this chap took over my place on the flying boat, and I reverted to his job on the base. Quite something. We'd taken a Chinese cook with us from Singapore. There were strong rumours that we'd shanghaied him. Whether this is really true or not, I don't know. But he was very annoyed, I know, when he got to the Andamans. And he was supposed to be our cook. Now, for 3 months, you can only take a limited amount of food. Well, you couldn't take any fresh food at all, really, because of the heat. So we were loaded up well with tins of everything. Nowadays you would think nothing of it, but it was like a grocer's store. It was tinned everything, vegetables and meats and all that kind of stuff, which was all very well, but after about a week of eating this stuff, the smell from around got quite strong. And of course we had to get our own loos prepared, you see. But fortunately, we didn't have to look after these ourselves, because also on this same island that we were on was a prison for Indian baddies, which consisted of murderers and anything else you like to mention. And so many of these, usually two, sometimes three or four, but usually two, were detailed to come down and look after us in the dockyard, because their boss was an Englishman. And they were detailed to come down, and they would do these unpleasant tasks of the loop. But you knew, if you knew that people around there had been eating tinned food for weeks by the time you got there. So another unusual point about this prison thing, the chap who was the boss used to wear a great big Panama type hat. I've never seen one like it before. And he used to have a stock whip, and he'd have leather boots despite the heat, and he would walk around banging his leg with the whip, and these chaps would skitter. He could never catch one of those. If they got near him, they were in trouble. And he was a real tough type of man, particularly suited for that job. And he was just a man's man, as it were. No time for any soft namby-pamby stuff. And the story went that prior to him taking on that job, he'd been over across to Burma and become a Buddhist monk. Now, they're the ones that shave their heads, and you see them on television quite a lot nowadays, with the yellow, the saffron robes, and they're not allowed to work for food or buy food. They've got to rely on the gifts from the natives, who are only too willing to give to these priests. His idea, his object, was to learn the language. And this is so the story went, and he's quite the type of man that you could think this was credible. The crews, the photography work went on, and the maintenance continued. But this was a bit tricky, as you can well imagine. As the boats were on the water all the time, there was no slipway for them to come up, and it got a bit tricksy when the fitter had to do his daily inspections, and if he had to do any spanner work, the spanner went over, it went in the sea, and that was it. And it was a bit dodgy going in there, because there had to be crocodiles around that particular bay, so you had to be on you know, the top line. The wireless operator was always there standing by to help with various larger movements of taking a prop off, for instance. And then you had a special metal framework which fitted onto the plane, so that with a canvas based bottom to it, but well above the water, about just below the level of the plane, the wing, so that should a tall drop or anything, you stood a good chance of getting it before it slid over. And props could be changed, and all sorts of normal maintenance was just a little difference about it. You had to be that much more careful, realising all the time underneath you was a pit, as it were, which you'd lose your things. And an engine could be replaced, which is quite a substantial thing, but it never happened while we were there, fortunately. But a small crane could be fitted onto the wing again, on the upper wing, and an engine could be manoeuvred, but it would take a lot of arrangements to get boats around with sufficient support to take the engine and replace it with the upper one. Refueling, there was a large store of petrol, but where this was kept I don't know, somewhere on the islands. And the natives, when we wanted refueling, the natives would bring alongside their native boat with a big sort of cast iron tank in the middle, and the petrol would be tipped into that, and from that would be pumped up into the tanks of the aircraft. This was no easy matter. It was done by the wireless operator and the fitter, and it was done with what they call a Zwicky pump. This pump fitted onto a special area on the aircraft. It was on the top of the fuselage, just in front of the wing, and you really pump by hand. And if you can imagine sitting in a blazing sun, because you had no shelter over your head, blazing sun, pumping up 500 gallons of petrol, you can just imagine our state by the time we'd finished.
You couldn't get the natives to do that for you?
Well, not really. They were so poorer class of intelligence. You couldn't really... You could only rely on them to do the easiest and more straightforward things, anything like that. And in any case, they looked upon aircraft as a sort of something from the heavens, and there were a few of them were a bit wary of them.
And then you flew back to Salita, did you?
No. What happened now, so far as I was concerned personally... Excuse me. The aircraft did go back to Salita, but this was in about January, which just about completed the 3 months. And I was left behind with a ground party. Now, off the aircraft went then to Rangoon and back down to Salita, and we were staying on, and we couldn't get away until the boat came for us. And the boats didn't come in all that regularly. They come in about every 4 or 5 months, and there wasn't one due in for another 4 months and 6 weeks, something like that. So we had a month and 6 weeks to scratch around and do whatever we wanted to do. One of my jobs now was to return batteries, 12 volt batteries,